It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's new kitchen science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. How about dial-a-smell? Let your pals sniff what's for dinner by telephoning the scents to them. Then there's the kitchen table that cleans itself. Now that one's a keeper. And this is only the beginning. Scientists keep dreaming up these kinds of things at MIT's Media Lab. And we've got a report. Jane and Michael Stern are on the boardwalk in Atlantic City eating saltwater taffy. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson explains why the fuss over old vine wines. Reporter Scott Haas is in Italy with a truffle hound named Diana and her farmer. And we have the scoop on edamame. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I was roaming the supermarket last night, and I started thinking about how many bottled dressings there are and how a lot of them don't deliver an awful lot of good taste. So I thought maybe a single, simple, homemade dressing concept might be helpful. The idea is you improvise one basic dressing that you can mix up just by shaking the ingredients together in a jar. And it keeps in the refrigerator for a week or more. Now, this dressing will be excellent on its own, but each time you use it, you could add different ingredients and make an entirely different recipe, from Italian to ranch to blue cheese. For great tasting homemade dressings, you do have to do a little hunting and gathering. But once it's done, it's over. So get some good-tasting olive oil and vinegars with great flavor. In the vinegar realm, you could choose from wine or cider vinegars, balsamic, Spanish sherry vinegar, or Japanese rice vinegar. I like rice vinegar because it's gentle and I need less oil with it. Also, it's great mixed with balsamic vinegar in a dressing. In the flavoring department, think organic fresh herbs, but if you can't get your hands on them, dried herbs will do just fine. Of course, there's garlic and onion. They're essential. And then there's cheeses, spices, chilies, sun-dried tomatoes, olives, capers. You can have a field day with all the possibilities. But let's start at the beginning. Here's the basic dressing. Now, you have to make this by taste, not by measurements. Take a screw-top jar, a pint one should work fine. Fill it a quarter full with good-tasting vinegar. Now add the same amount of olive oil. Shake it up and taste it. See if it needs more oil or more vinegar. Then you could add salt and pepper. Okay, let's say you want to dress a salad. This simple oil and vinegar dressing with the salt and pepper is the true classic Italian or French dressing. The French call it vinaigrette, and you can use it just as it is. But if you love a particular herb, sprinkle it over the salad as you toss it with the dressing. Turn the basic dressing into a Dijon dressing by putting some of it in a bowl, stir in some Dijon mustard, some tarragon, and some minced garlic or shallot. Keep tasting and keep mixing, and that way you'll know when you hit it the way you want it. How about a honey mustard dressing? Take that Dijon dressing, stir in more mustard, and some honey or brown sugar to taste. Some people also add a little bit of mayonnaise to that. Blue cheese dressing. There is nothing better, as far as I'm concerned. What you do here is you take the basic dressing, you add a little blue cheese, a hint of garlic, and that's it. If you like the creamy style, do what I just said, but then stir in a bit of mayo and sour cream. Now, ranch dressing is a great favorite. You can mix it right in the salad bowl. Just stir together equal parts of your basic dressing, some buttermilk, and mayo. Then add minced fresh scallions, some fresh basil, and parsley. Garlic is great in ranch dressing, but add it gradually to keep it from overpowering everything else. Now, here's something to think about. Once you've got your dressings, you should know that each one of them makes a dynamite marinade. For instance, try marinating shrimp in that ranch dressing. and then grill them. How about beef in honey mustard? Do it with kebabs. Keep them rare, but grill them until they're crusty. The Dijon dressing is going to be wonderful with something like chicken breasts. There, just put them in the dressing overnight, and then put them in a sauté pan or roast them in the oven. And then that basic oil and vinegar dressing, use that to marinate vegetables that you're going to roast or you're going to grill. So try making your own salad dressings this week and try turning them into marinades. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, we've the latest in kitchen research from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Now, they've set a bunch of scientists loose on the kitchen of the future. We're going to hear what they've conjured. Ever hear of wines from old vines? Well, supposedly they can be something special. Wine expert Joshua Wesson tells us what to check out and what to skip. Reporter Scott Haas is met up with an Italian truffle hound and her master. They're taking him on a hunt for the king of fungus, Italy's great white. We have the queen of the soybean, Dana Jacoby. She's going to tell us what to do with the newest soybean. It's fresh, it's green, and it's called edamame. Then, as we do every week in the second half of the show, we are opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we found the jackpot of candy for you in Atlantic City, New Jersey, on the boardwalk at a place called Frelinger's. It's been there since 1885.
You know, Atlantic City is, I was getting sort of a bum rap. I mean, it's, you know, people are criticizing that it's, you know, this kind of dumpy place filled with overwrought casinos. But there are aspects of Atlantic City, including the Miss America pageant, that really take you back in time. And I remember as a kid, which is really going back in time, going to Frelinger's Taffy, which is on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. And no matter, you know, what Trump casino or what's around you, the thing that does not change is the crashing surf, the beautiful boardwalk, and this incredible saltwater taffy, which is probably comes in a greater variety of flavors than you can imagine. But my personal favorite is taffy that is put on a popsicle stick and then dipped in dark chocolate. So it's like a big saltwater taffy lollipop.
Preferably molasses-flavored taffy, because the molasses and dark chocolate go together great.
I've always wondered, what does saltwater taffy actually mean?
Absolutely nothing. It means that you buy it near saltwater. That's all it means.
Yeah, we were always curious about that, too. We figured, you know, somebody had a bucket, they were running out to the ocean and, you know, bringing it back and pouring it into the taffy machine. But it's just kind of, it has to do with proximity rather than ingredients. And it, you know, it probably is just, you know, pulled sugar. I mean, it's, you know, one of these very, very simple, simple but hypnotic things to watch being made. It sort of pulls this kind of long, squishy, silly putty-like taffy into a figure eight, and it just kind of goes on and on and on and on until it's pulled to perfection. And at Frelinger's, you can watch the taffy being made, and then you've probably got, I don't know, 25 different varieties, from banana flavored to chocolate to vanilla to pistachio. But again, as Michael and I were saying earlier, the molasses saltwater taffy on a stick dipped in wonderful dark chocolate is perfection. And you just walk outside and there's the boardwalk and the ocean.
And the salt water.
And the salt water. Do they do anything else? They just do taffy?
Oh, no, they do all kinds of candies. I mean, it's a full-service candy store. And one of the things they make there, which is the thing that I can never resist, whatever it's called, because it has different names around the country, is that hard, crunchy molasses. I guess it's kind of baked molasses, sheathed in very dark chocolate. It's the kind of molasses that when you bite into it, it literally melts on your tongue. It's the stuff that in Wisconsin is called fairy food.
Ooh, but wait a minute, wait a minute. They're also famous for macaroons,
oh,
which
yeah.
they do by hand. Good macaroons, almond macaroons, are hard to find. And the box that they come in, if you buy a dozen almond macaroons, absolutely looks like it's sort of from the Art Deco days, or mm-hmm. maybe from the World's, you know, Fair of the Trilon and Paris Fair. It's Frelinger's, it does everything the old-fashioned way, and a good light almond macaroon is not easy to find anymore.
Okay. Now I've got a place to find some great candy. Thanks, guys.
And a boardwalk to walk it off on.
And salt water.
And salt water to enjoy.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
The Stern's newest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. They stop by the Splendid Table every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a classically trained sommelier who took a left turn a while ago. He wants wine to be a democratic drink, like beer. Something you can enjoy with anything, from Big Macs to Thai takeout. He stops by regularly to answer our questions and share his finds. Hey, Josh. Hi.
Hello. Back to you.
What is the deal with old vines? You know, wines made from old vines.
Old vines. Well, you know, I just turned 45, so I have a particular sensitivity to old vines. When a grapevine gets planted, it can't even produce fruit that's usable by a winemaker for 3 or 4 years. And then after the fourth year, you pluck grapes off, you make wine, and vines come into their own at about 10, and mm-hmm. then from 10 to maybe 20 or 25, they're really at their peak, and then they begin to go into a decline in terms of the number of grapes that a vine can produce. But just like a person, the older the vine gets, the wiser it gets. And when you get fruit that comes off of, oh, let's say a 45-year-old mm-hmm. Vine, not unlike me, you would you'd be plucking fruit that has all of the energy and concentration of flavor that the vine can give it. And the fewer grapes that come off this old tree trunk of a vine will end up tasting more intense and hopefully make better wine, because the grapes really have the wisdom of age embedded in them.
But aren't there a lot of variables with this? I mean, I'm thinking about how it's been cared for. Was it worth it to begin with? I mean, let's face it, like people, some people don't get better when they get older.
You know, you're absolutely right. There are all sorts of variables that come into play. And I think that the whole notion of old vines is a bit misleading in terms of being directly connected to quality, because some old vines, wines are extraordinary because their vines have been tended to appropriately, and others mm-hmm. Are just marketed as a, you know, sort of alleged benefit. But in fact, if the vines have not been taken care of, they won't produce that exquisite concentration of fruit flavors. So you have to be careful and know the integrity of the producer as much as the words old vines, or as the French like to call it, vieille vigne.
Yeah.
And it's not a guarantee of excellence.
Is there more, generally, more red than white old vine wines, or does it matter?
It does matter, because even though a white wine, a white grape vine can grow just as long as a red grape vine can, the quality of the fruit that comes off of really old white grape vines is less desirable than the red grape equivalent. So you tend to find in places where people let vines stay in the ground and where they tend to them carefully, in places like the Barossa Valley in Australia, or in the area around the Cape in South Africa, or in some cases even in California, where there are vines that survived the brush with Prohibition, old vines, Zinfandels, that 95% of wines labeled old vines are in fact made from red grapes.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the action is.
Okay, now I need suggestions. Some that I can go out and try to get a sense of what an old vine wine can be about.
Well, technically, anywhere that red grapes are grown, you'll find old vines lying around the vineyard somewhere. But the places where you can find a lot of modestly priced and well-made old vines wines are California, and in particular Zinfandel from California, because it's one of the oldest grapevines to be planted and nurtured in California. And I like the Renwood old vine Zinfandel. 1998 is their current release, and
mm-hmm.
for about $15, you can look back almost 100 years. It's like a time machine, because you're tasting grapes that are coming off of vines that are almost 100 years old, and it's really quite magical.
Hmm.
But California, of course, isn't the only place where they're growing old vines, and in fact, there are more old vines in the old world than there are in the new world. And if you go to Spain, where they specialize in old vines fruit, in fact, they don't make such a big deal out of it. But in the central part of Spain, in the area called Catalud, you've got an old vines wine from Viña Alarba. It's made from Grenache, or they call it Garnacha. And for about $10, you grab a bottle of their 1999, and you will be stunned by the intensity of the fruit there. It's like taking every great red fruit that you could ever imagine, crushing it between your hands, and then boiling the juice down, and then you get this incredible elixir. It's really phenomenal wine.
Hmm.
I drink it all the time. Sometimes I have it for breakfast.
Must be wonderful over Cheerios. Okay, anybody else you want to tell us about?
Yeah, you know, South Africa never gets the respect that it deserves, but there's some absolutely extraordinary red wine that comes out of the area around Cape Town. And Beierskloof is the top producer of a grape that's peculiar to South Africa. It's called Pinotage, P-I-N-O-T-A-G-E. And their old vines Pinotage is all of about $12. And it tastes like a cross between a Cabernet and a Syrah. It's got the spiciness of a Syrah.
Mm.
It's got the density and chunkiness of a Cabernet. It's full of all sorts of blueberry fruit. And although it'll leave your teeth stained purple, you'll be happier and better looking for it.
That's also the sign of living well, I think. Purple teeth. Josh, thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Joshua Wesson is the creator of the bestsellers chain of wine shops. You can find his old vine picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, kitchen intelligence at MIT, truffle hunting in Italy with a dog named Diana, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. When you think about the kitchen of the future, what comes to mind? Push buttons, you know, a la Star Trek? Maybe no kitchen at all? Well, there are some people who spend a lot of time thinking about the kitchen of the future, and many of them gather at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in their media lab. We're going to our favorite informant, researcher Joseph Kay, also known as Joe Fish. He works on what they call kitchen intelligence. Now, this is a bunch of scientists contemplating the kitchen of the future and letting their imaginations fly. Joe Fish, welcome back.
Lynn, nice to be back.
Okay, so what's been happening at the lab? What are you guys working on?
We got a couple of projects that are ticking over right now. I spent the last year thinking a lot about smell. What can happen if computers can make smells and we can communicate using smells? That's been very interesting. We've also, today I've been working on a vibrating table that can clean itself so that you can spill all the crumbs and it can wash them all off into the sink.
I picture a table doing the shimmy.
That's roughly what it is. You know, if you take something and you put it on a piece of paper, and you move the piece of paper forward slowly, then back fast, then forward slowly and back fast, you'll move that to the far end of the piece of paper. That's the way this table works. We use what's called a sawtooth wave to brush all the crumbs off it.
That's not a bad idea. Tell me more about the smell research.
We started thinking about what happens in kitchens. When I was here last, I mentioned that the appliance that's used the most in kitchens is the telephone. And mainly what people do in kitchens is communicate. But still the most important thing is the food, is the cooking, is the eating. So we wanted to think about communicating that value. How can we communicate what's cooking in one kitchen to another one or to another room? And we developed a system called InStink. And the way that InStink worked was on one end we had a spice rack, and on the other end we had an output device that was basically an airbrush. And so if someone picked up cinnamon and nutmeg and ginger on one end, then it would come out the other end and you'd smell cinnamon and nutmeg and ginger. So you wouldn't know exactly what they were cooking. But maybe it was spice cake or maybe it was apple pie. But it's very different to something like garam masala and cumin and coriander. It's a very different set of smells.
Mm-hmm. But how do you see this being used?
That was really a prototype device to see if it was possible to convey information using smell. We went a bit more elaborate and did things like stock prices and just knowing that a loved one is thinking of you. But I think first what will happen is that people will use these technologies for games. The idea that, you know, as you're playing your racing game, you smell the smell of burning rubber.
Wait a minute. A minute ago, you mentioned stock prices. How would this apply to the stock market?
Well, we did a thing called dollars and cents. The thing with stock prices is that mostly you don't care. You only care if they go up a lot or if they go down a lot. Otherwise, if they're just meandering along as normal, it's not really that important. So we hooked up a stock ticker to the NASDAQ index. And when you came into the building, if you smelled mint, then it meant that the stock prices were going up because you were making money. And if you smelled lemon, then the stock price was going down because the market had gone sour. And that very simple piece of information tells you a whole lot of information. There's a whole world that's encapsulated in that single amount of smell.
It's also engaging a sense that we don't associate with that kind of thing. I mean, we never associate scent with business practice.
Exactly. And I think that partly that's a technological limitation. We don't associate smell with computers. But when you think back 15 years ago, people didn't think about sound being associated with computers either. And now we're used to this rich world of sound where MP3s are all over the place. That's the kind of change in technology that we see happening here.
Have you done any work on food in cars?
The best thing we've came up with right now is a coffee machine in your car. We did a lot of looking at what other people have done in this area, and there's actually not that much. And more than anything else, people drink coffee in their cars. You know, on the way to work, it's a very important part of that getting ready for work ritual. This isn't something you want to sort of, you know, actually do while you're going along. You know, we don't want a full espresso machine where you have billowing steam going all over the inside of the car and misting up the windshield. But thinking about a way we can do this elegantly and do it well. The coffee idea actually came out of just drinking in cars. People drink water is the other thing that people drink a lot of. And particularly if you've got kids, the idea of being able to wash your kids' hands in a car is very tempting.
I'm picturing my glove compartment is now a push button where I can have my cappuccino with extra foam, and then there'll be a sink in the back seat so that the kids can wash their hands, right?
That's exactly the kind of thing we're looking at right now.
Now, I read that you have been working with historians, food historians. What are you learning from them?
That's right. A woman called Barbara Wheaton, who's absolutely fabulous. I'm a completely a paid-up member of the Barbara Wheaton fan club. Has come on, and she's working at MIT once a week. And we've started to look at the history of food as so to understand the future. And I found a lovely example of this the other day. We were visiting Plymouth Plantation, and Plymouth Plantation is one of those places where everyone dresses up like it's 1623, and they all speak in authentic accents, and it's just fabulous. And I found a piece of what I think of as a piece of technology there called a trig. And a trig is a cup from the 1600s, and it's got three handles. And the point of having three handles is that if you've got one handle, then you can have a hot liquid in there, and you can pick it up by the handle, and you don't burn yourself on the cup itself. If you've got two handles, you have a really big cup, because you can pick it up with both hands. If you've got three handles, the point of three handles is that you can pick it up, and you can drink from it, and then you pass it on to the next person, and then they drink from it. It's sort of a cup for sharing. And that idea of a trig is, I think, very important. I'd like to create a trig that you could use over a distance, some artifact that encourages sharing and cooperation among kitchens, but not limited by geography anymore, so that you can't just pass it to the person next to you, but I can pass it to my mother who lives in Paris, or my sister who lives in New York. That idea that you can communicate through food that way.
A virtual trig. Joseph, thank you.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure as ever.
Joseph Kay is a researcher at MIT's Media Labs. It's truffle season in Italy, the time of year when the rare white truffle is ripe for stalking. The competition is unbelievably fierce. Now, you can't cultivate a white truffle. You have to hunt them in the wild. And that's where we find reporter Scott Haas, in an undisclosed location somewhere in the Piedmont region of northern Italy.
This is Scott Haas, and I'm in Italy. I'm in the Alba region of Italy where the white truffles come from. I love white truffles, and I'm about to go on a white truffle hunt. I can't believe it because we're standing here with a farmer and his daughter, and they've got this cute little brown dog. We're at the edge of a hazelnut forest, and we're all going to go into the hazelnut forest with the farmer and his dog, and we're going to go try to find truffles. I've gone on mushroom hunts before, you know, for morels and that sort of thing, and that was fun, but this is the king of fungus, and I'm going to find, I don't know if I'm going to find, but I hope to find some white truffles. And there's a sweet little brown dog that she's the farmer's daughter's holding. She's trying to calm the dog down. The dog's about as excited about finding truffles as I am.
Diana, see?
Diana. And Francesca, you're going to be translating for us?
Oh, yes, of course.
Fantastic,
of
great.
Course.
How many dogs have you trained over the many years that you've truffle hunted to do this? I mean,
diciamo una trentina.
Hey, da quanti anni che fa il trifulao?
Avevo 12 anni.
He was 12 years old when he started to be a trifulao. Now he's 60, so he trained more or less 30 dogs.
And how of the 30 dogs, how does this one rank?
She, dice questo è il migliore o uno dei più di questi 30 che lei ha addestrato finora. Questo è uno dei migliori.
Questo è uno dei migliori.
Yeah, she's one of the best. Intelligente. One of the best. She's intelligent. She's clever dog.
How did they train her to hunt for truffles? How did they teach her?
Yeah, just they promised them a reward after they have found a truffle. But they promise them a piece of thick bread or a piece of bread or just to play with them after they found the truffle. Okay, so we can start.
We're entering a hazelnut grove near the truffle hunter's house, and Diana, the dog, has her nose to the ground. She's leading us into the woods. There are several other dogs in the background. They look like bloodhounds, and I guess they're waiting their turn. He's going to unleash her now.
Diana.
The dog is running around really, not frantic, but very focused. She's hunting. She's very, very keen on finding something.
The Piedmontese dialect. She's saying, Vensi, which means, come in, Diana, come on.
Diana, Vensi, tu non Diana,
She's really having a ball. She looks like she's having fun. She's working so hard to find these truffles. It's like watching a golden retriever go after a duck that's been shot. I mean, she's hunting for the truffles. She's digging. She's found something here. She's digging a little hole, and he wants her to dig carefully so as not to harm the truffle. And what has she found there?
Beta.
And he's smelling the soil, but he's sure there's something here.
Beta.
Maybe it's a really big truffle.
Beta.
And he's telling her to wait.
Diana.
And the earth is coming up, and there you go. Nice big black truffle.
That's really great.
Oh, so now she gets a reward, and she's going to get a a biscuit. And she's still digging. Maybe there's another one. No, not for you.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. So now he buries the hole again so that no one else will find it. And now Deanna's going to go find another one. Can I ask him some questions?
Yes.
And I want to say in advance, to say your name.
Cardelli Giuseppe.
How did he first find the passion for truffle? I mean, what was the first reason he decided to do this?
Okay, perché c'è stata questa passione per il tartufo? Qual è la ragione, la motivazione che l'ha spinta?
Passione quando toglie il tartufo, come mi salta addosso, okay. Come...
Yeah.
Soddisfazione è quella.
Mostly the most important satisfaction was to see the dog while he's searching the truffle, or she's searching for the truffle. The way she jumps on him when he found or she found the truffle. So this is the best.
So to someone who's never had a truffle before, how would you describe it? What's so special about truffles?
Okay, dice per chi immaginiamo una persona tipo anche un cittadino americano che non ha mai mangiato.
Ma è una roba.
Indescrivibile. In a way, can be described.
Chi le piace e chi
it's very subjective.
Lo si mangia su tante cose.
And you can have it on many things, especially handmade pasta, noodles and eggs.
And so the flavor is like nothing else, I suppose.
Qual è il quindi il sapore deve essere qualcosa di indescrivibile, quindi un sapore intenso e
non
un sapore.
Si può mettere solo su certe mangiare.
The truffle can be put only on certain type of dish because it's so intense, so strong.
Il fungo. E poi?
E cosa? It's difficult because it's a mixture between the mushroom and then different. Mm-hmm. Different. It feels the tree. Mm-hmm. It feels the soil. It feels everything mixed together. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to define a clear flavor, a clear taste.
Parliamo di quello bianco, non di questi,
Sì.
Quello bianco. Hop. Diana. Appa, l'ha mangiata.
She's eating.
Il tartufo più gustoso.
Invece quello nero, invece
the dog just ran off in order to have a snack in the middle of our interview.
The white truffle is the white truffle of this area.
Is the prized one.
The most appreciated one.
Why doesn't he use pigs instead of dogs?
Okay. Allora, di nuovo, quindi ripetiamo la stessa cosa. Perché non usano i maiali invece del cane?
Ma qui i maiali non vanno bene andare per tartufi. Non si può caricare sulla macchina il maiale.
Yeah, it's very difficult to carry a pig in the car. This is the first reason why they don't use the pigs. And also the area is not good for the pigs. And also another reason is the pigs are too rough. They are not gentle or athletic as the dogs.
Well, I just wanted to thank him for showing me, and I have a lot of respect for his work, and it's fascinating. I've learned a lot.
Okay, voleva ringraziarlo perché rispetta molto il suo lavoro e dice che
ma
è una cosa molto molto bella.
Io delle volte parto alle 2 di notte, arrivo alle 8, alle 10 di mattina senza trovare niente.
Sometimes he goes out of the house to look for the truffle at 2:00 in the morning because it's usually done during the night, and then he arrives back at home at 8:10 in the morning, and sometimes even without finding a truffle.
I'm sure.
Because
I'm
sometimes there are days in which you don't find
it. That's hunting.
That's
hunting. So, grazie.
Okay, so, he thanks you very much.
Diana, Bessie, torna Bessie.
I have to tell you, as someone who has spent time at the truffle market in Italy, this was a real coup. Usually truffle hunters will tell you anything you want to know except where they find their truffles. The pinnacle of truffle eating, by the way, is getting your hands on a fresh white one from the Alba area. The test of a great white fresh truffle is, if you can smell it several feet away, you've got a pearl. And I'm sorry, guys, but canned truffles and truffle oil, they just don't compare. Now, if you're lucky enough and flush enough to get your hands on that fresh white truffle, here's what you do with it. First, store it overnight in the fridge, buried in a bowl of unshelled eggs. The scent of the truffle is going to permeate the shell, so the next day you can make truffle-scented scrambled eggs. Now, use up your truffle fast, in about a week, because as it loses moisture, it loses flavor. And this is why you never store it in rice or pasta. You keep it in the fridge, you loosely wrap it in paper towel, and you put it in a sealed plastic container. And you change the paper every day. For the ultimate truffle experience, do what the truffle hunter told Scott to do. Toss some fresh homemade pasta with butter and a little Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese, and then shave white truffle over each serving. The trick is you never cook a white truffle. You just shave it onto simple dishes. Now, you can find my recipe for classic white truffle pasta on our website, splendidtable.org. Have you seen those fresh soybeans called edamames? Well, the trick is figuring out what to do with them. My producer bought a bag of frozen ones months ago, and she's using it as an ice pack. So we're going to the author of the book, Amazing Soy, Dana Jacoby. Hey, Dana, welcome.
Delighted to be with you, Lynn.
Okay, so what do we do with these green soybeans? Help.
Oh, there's a lot of really nice things that you can do with them. Some of your listeners may know that the traditional way of eating them, the way they eat them most often in Japan and China, which is where they originated, is in the pod. It almost looks like a little sugar snap pea, but slightly fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
To cook the whole thing in the pod in very heavily salted water, and then drain it and cool it, and serve it sort of lukewarm. In Japan, this is the traditional bar snack. They eat them all the time with beer. And part of the fun is you get a little bit of salt from the outside of the pod as you hold it up to your mouth and squeeze it so the little bean inside pops into your mouth.
Uh-huh.
And then another name for these green vegetable soybeans is sweet bean, because they really and truly taste kind of sweet.
And you don't eat the pod, right?
No, you do not eat the pod. And then also at stores, they can buy them already cooked and ready to eat. It's
mm-hmm.
a great snack food. But some supermarkets are selling them already shelled. It looks, and that's what I think your producer has. It looks kind of like a bag of chubby lima beans.
Right, exactly. What if I want to cook them into a dish? What
well,
do I do?
You can start with things that are totally easy, like throw a handful of them into minestrone soup when you're making it.
Mm-hmm.
Blanch them slightly. They're a little bit cooked, as most frozen vegetables are, but boil them about 5 minutes just in plain water, the shelled beans,
mm-hmm.
and sprinkle them over like a green salad. They're a nice addition to a niçoise salad, along with the tuna fish and all the other things.
Hmm. Can I stir fry them?
Yes. One of the nice things about edamame is they hold up very well in cooking. Also, you can puree them. One of the best things I ever had, Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, of the famous Jean-Georges restaurant in New York City,
yeah.
does a sauce where he purees edamame and a load of fresh cilantro and other seasonings together. And you get sort of a, you know, like a pureed sauce.
Mm.
It would go wonderfully with some salmon and sautéed spinach with garlic and olive oil and edamame and, be a little generous with the salt. It's just wonderful.
So it sounds like salt is one of the keys. I like the idea of the bar snack, I have to tell you.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a glass of white wine and just suck those edamame. Hey, Dana, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dana Jacoby's latest book is Amazing Soy. Now, you can find Dana's recipe for Brunswick-style sweet soybeans on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, time for our weekly food challenge. Here is the question of the week. How many cuts of meat are on one steer? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your call, so you can give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food challenge. Now, the question was, how many cuts of meat are there on one steer? Believe it or not, there are about 30 different cuts on one animal. Talk about confusing. I mean, how do you tell which one to buy for which recipe? Well, there are clues. First, all meat dishes break down into two categories. Tough cuts, that are cooked slow with some kind of moisture, and tender cuts, which can be cooked fast and on their own. But the big question is, how do you tell the difference? Well, I have an easy way to tell. First, you have to do this. Get down on all fours and walk around. I'm not kidding. This is really going to tell you exactly how this works. You have to figure out which parts of your body are moving. Your hips, your shoulders, your legs, your belly, and your neck, right? Okay, where there's a lot of muscle movement, the meat is tough. Now, where is there very little movement? Your back and your upper rib area. That's the tender parts. Now, there's a code. God forbid butchers should just say shoulder, hip, rib. No, they had to come up with complicated names. But in those names that you see on those packages of meat, there is always one word that is a tip-off. Now, for instance, chuck is the shoulder. It's usually chewy to really tough, but it has great taste. Round is the hip. Think your rear end, okay? That's chewy with okay taste. And loin? Well, loin is the top of the back, and it usually means tender, like in sirloin steak. Okay, there's a lot more to learn about meat, but this should solve some of the puzzle. So many cuts, so little time. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. Let's see, who is waiting? We have Joni on the line. Hey, Joni, what do you want to talk about?
I love calamari. I love it anyway. I love it in pastas and soups. And the best that we have from a restaurant here in St. Louis is... they flash fry it, and they serve it with the Cornichon mayonnaise dipping sauce, and it's outstanding. But recently I went to our international market to purchase some squid, and I found a large frozen, what was labeled a squid tube. It weighed a little over a pound. It was clean.
that's a squid outside of a movie.
It was big. It was great. It was something out of the blue, out of the deep blue. But I've heard it's known as a squid steak. Do you have any suggestions on how to fix this? Does it need to be pounded or marinated?
Now, it's one tube, what they refer to as a tube.
Uh-huh.
And it's one, now you know what the tube is? It's a squid body.
Right, right.
Yeah, because the squid is actually, if you were to see a squid, if you remove the head and the tentacles, what you've got, and there's sort of like a clear, it looks like clear plastic.
Yeah.
In the center, right in the center of the body, that's the bone.
Uh-huh.
And if you remove that in the ink sac, what you have is something that's almost like an elongated ice cream cone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the flesh of the squid that we eat. So you've got a real, you've got the mother or
uh-huh.
the granddaddy of squids if it weighs a pound.
Right.
Now, this is the deal with most squid and with cuttlefish, which is a member of this, you know, it's the same family.
Right.
Is you either cook it very short time or very slow. So you cook it no more than a minute or two. Mm-hmm. That's where you come in with the flash frying you talked about.
Right.
You know, hot pan in one side, other side out.
Right.
And it's still tender. Or you cook it for 40 minutes, 50 minutes until it just, you know, becomes meltingly tender mm-hmm. in a braise or a stew. I would do this with your squid body, with your squid tube. I'd cut it down the center so you flatten it out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I take a little piece of it and try the flash fry. Just put a little teeny bit of oil in a small skillet, mm-hmm. get it pretty hot, drop it in, add some salt and pepper, give it a 30 seconds and flip it over 30 seconds.
Okay.
Taste it. If it's tender, then the world is our oyster, and I can tell you, about, you know, a little marinade, a little rub, you know, how you can deglaze the pan, you know, after you've taken it out, take all that nice business in the pan and make a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
If it's chewy, it means it's a more mature animal.
Okay.
And it really was meant for stewing. Mm-hmm. So then what you would do is you would braise it. So you may, you know, and if you want to do it in an Italian style that's very popular there, you might simmer it with fresh tomatoes and olives and capers and anchovies and a ton of garlic and a little, you know, you're with me. I
gotta
can hear this.
Garlic.
Yes. Yeah. Gotta have the garlic. And that could be eaten as like a fish stew.
Mm-hmm.
It could be also tossed with pasta.
That sounds wonderful.
And if you're going to do the other thing, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you might do is rub it with the garlic and the fresh basil and, you know, maybe even a little few bits of anchovy and do a flash fry and then deglaze the pan with white wine.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And just drizzle, you know, it's going to be a teaspoon or two of liquid over it, and you serve everybody essentially the steaks.
It's wonderful, and it's about $1 a pound.
That is remarkable.
It is.
And do you know the other thing about squid? A, it's the least fishy of all fish, and people are so squeamish about it.
Uh-huh.
It really is the least fishy of all fish. And the other thing is, it's one of the best freezing fish. It loses very little in freezing. So it's a great fish.
Right.
If you do live in St. Louis,
uh-huh.
you know, where you're not at the ocean, and you can really get it in great shape.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Joni, thank you. Goodbye. We are so squeamish about these things, and squid is so good. And by the way, very low in calories, and I think zip fat. I mean, there's probably almost no fat in a squid. Okay. Debbie is up next. So, Debbie, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about food gifts from the USA from my Italian relatives.
Where are your Italian relatives?
They live in Bracciano, which is just outside of Rome.
Uh-huh.
And all I know that they really like is peanut butter. They can't get it there, apparently.
Right.
So they're going to get peanut butter. They're going to get peanut butter cups. I'm going to throw in a few Hershey bars because, as you probably know, the chocolate's a little bit different.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And I thought I might bake some chocolate chip cookies while I was there.
Now you're going to visit them and you want to bring them gifts? Is that the idea?
I want to bring them some things that maybe they haven't had before. I know that they do a lot of things better than we do. You know?
Yeah, but there are things we do that are a lot better than
what are
than
they?
What have. Oh, now come on. Now let us not be intimidated here, Debbie.
I'm not intimidated. I just need your expertise.
Well, yeah, but I think you're right on the track. The peanut butter, mm-hmm. The chocolate chip cookies. I think great idea. Are they really into food?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Because not every Italian is. You know, it's not part of the genetic structure.
Not every single one of them.
Okay.
Some of them.
You know, the other thing I like to bring to friends in Europe occasionally, it's a schlep. American wine.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, pick a white and a red. Maybe a Zinfandel, since that grape, although it does appear in other parts of the world, it's really kind of California's grape.
Okay.
You know, pick a nice Zinfandel and then pick maybe a white, a Sauvignon Blanc, or a Chardonnay may be almost too much, but a Sauvignon Blanc.
I'm on the east end of Long Island and we have quite a few.
Hey, that's right. That's right. Maybe bring some of your local wines. Taste some, find ones you like. I think that would be just great.
Okay.
You know the other thing?
What?
Marshmallows.
Okay.
And do they have an open fire? By any chance?
Yeah, they do. They have a little country house.
Hey, you know what? You introduce them to toasted marshmallows, and you know what else you should do?
S'mores.
You got it. You got it. Now, if you want to be a real fanatic, you can make your own graham crackers.
Oh, and no, thank you.
Okay, there we go. No, but the point is, I think that would be such a hoot.
Okay.
So think wine, think chocolate chip cookies, think brownies, the peanut butter.
What about Jell-O?
Well, not a bad idea.
Not gourmet, but...
You have a good point. You know, and the other thing is maple syrup.
Maple syrup.
Maple syrup, but not necessarily... And maybe you make them pancakes.
These heavy bottles, Lynn.
I know, I'm sorry. Well, you can get a plastic container, but real Vermont. You can get it in little cans.
That's great.
You know, those you can tuck in. My mom used to go, she used to be in Italy like several months every year with, you know, with family, friends. She always made everybody pancakes, and she brought her own maple syrup.
Thanks.
There you go.
You see?
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You're right on. You didn't need me. Hey,
I'll
have a great...
I'll send you pictures of pancake breakfast.
I would love it. Okay. I would love it. And peanut butter sandwiches.
Okay, peanut butter and jelly, right?
You got it. You got
okay.
it.
Thanks, Lynn.
Hey, Debbie, thanks. Have a great trip.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can get to us at 800-537-5252. We have Jim on the line. Jim, what's on your mind?
Well, I had been trying to get kiwi wine.
Kiwi wine?
From a variety of vineyards in New Zealand or China or Australia. And I've not been lucky. I see the companies and I see what they offer on the Internet, but I can't get them distributed to the United States, or I don't know where I can find a distributor. They were unable to give me the name of one and could not send any cases to me independently.
I'm just thinking about there are probably importers who carry a lot of Australian products and New Zealand products. I'm not sure about Chinese products. And, you know, if you look on the back of some of the very large companies from Australia or New Zealand, the wine companies, you look on the back of the bottle,
right,
you'll see the name of an importer. Now, maybe contacting that importer might be a way of finding out if that person can get their hands on and bring in for you kiwi wine. There's one other thing that comes to mind. There is a mail order catalog called The Grateful Palate, and the guy who does that mail order catalog, I think, also brings in wines from either Australia, New Zealand, or both. I'm a little vague on this, but the Grateful Palate, I know they've got a website, and you can check out what his name is and send him an email asking him if perhaps he can get his hands on some.
Oh, this is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it'll help you. I think this may be one of the more unusual requests we've had on the Splendid Table.
Well, I tell you what, if I can get the wine, I'll send you a bottle.
All right, you're on.
Okay.
You're on. We have never turned down a bottle of something new.
Okay.
Or something old, come to think of it. Hey, Jim, thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Hope it helps. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
You can get to us at 800-537-5252. And let's see now. We've got Chris calling. So, Chris, what pressing question do you have?
I've built a couple of small houses, and I'm going to build another one that is described probably best as a cabin or a cottage, and I'm interested in making a small, efficient kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And I cook, but I am not a gourmet cook. I am by myself, so I don't need a kitchen bigger than a one-person size. I'm wondering if there are any kitchen design books that talk about efficiency in the same sense that the Cornell School of Economics used to talk about the work triangle.
Oh, yeah, the famous work triangle between the refrigerator, the stove, and the sink.
Correct.
Yeah, which, by the way, a lot of designers now say doesn't apply if you have more than one person and they're rethinking it and all that. Are you a builder? Do you build and sell, or do you build houses for yourself?
I build houses for myself, and then when I get, it turns out when I get done, I sell them and move on and apply what I've learned in the past to the new construction, so... That's what I'm trying to do now, is learn more in particular about kitchens.
About kitchens.
Tending to cook more as I get older.
So you're looking for designs for kitchens that are small and very efficient and not necessarily, you know, filled with fancy, expensive equipment?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. This is two things come to mind. One is a book by an architect whose name I always mispronounce, but the book is called The Not Too Big House.
Yeah, Sarah Susanka.
Thank you. I always think of her as Sarah Susquehanna.
Ah,
Sarah Susanka. Thank you. Thank
right.
you.
You've
read it. Okay. You know the other place I would go for what I think of as real world kitchen design ideas?
Mm-hmm.
Better Homes and Gardens Publications.
Really?
Yes. You know why? They have the resources to test, try stuff out. They are dealing with readers who often do not feel like spending $5,000 for a stove,
right,
you know, or installing a wood-fired oven.
Right.
I have found that they are really right on when it comes to realistic kitchen designs.
So they might have a website as well.
They probably do. And the other thing is, you know what I would do? I would talk to cooking teachers in your area.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of this because I am one myself.
Mm-hmm.
People who have spent
much of their time in a kitchen often have some real practical ideas.
Oh, yeah.
For what
Absolutely.
Works. You know, for instance, you never want a two-tiered or multi-tiered island. It is the greatest waste of space. You see people with these, you know, islands that are divided into steps. You want to drive yourself nuts or you want to have accidents, that's the way to do it. You want the largest flat open surface you can have so you can spread out.
Uh-huh.
Don't chop up your counter space if you can avoid it.
Right.
Give yourself as much elbow room and clear space as you can.
Right.
So at any rate, I think those are two sources.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks
and
very
by
much.
The way, one other one, family circle. Again, the same concept. Dealing with a lot of real world problems.
I'll be darned. Okay.
I mean, I know you don't think of that. You think of the fancy stuff, but I think they're really great.
Great.
Hey, good luck. And
thank you.
I'd love to know how it all turns out.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with a quote from Rose Kennedy on her 100th birthday. She said, "I'm like old wine. They don't bring me out very often, but I'm well preserved." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. John Marston produced the truffle piece for us, and thanks to Swiss Air for getting them there. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.